Bhagavata's words.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So, I was talking to Sandy the other day, and she suggested that I might talk about the process of taking the precepts in Soto Zen. So, that's what I'm going to do today. Thank you, Sandy. So I'm going to talk about briefly what the precepts are, how it works, and we have a little brochure called Taking the Precepts that's out front out there if you want to read it later. And I'm going to kind of use that as the basis of the talk. So, these are called the Bodhisattva precepts. And a Bodhisattva, we can talk about Bodhisattva in many ways, and we have here. But in this context, Bodhisattva is a person who is dedicated to realizing the path of Buddhist teachings. For the benefit of themselves, for sure. But also for the benefit of all beings. So that's kind of a Herculean task, right? They are someone who follows the path of awakening to the best of their ability. So when I read the precepts here, I'm going to read through them, you'll see that they're virtually impossible to do. In fact, they are impossible to do. So we don't get into what Catholics call the sin of scrupulosity. I really, really like this. The sin of scrupulosity is basically religious perfectionism, where you, for example, you might have a prayer that you're supposed to say, and you make sure you say it, and you focus on every word, and you're like, and then afterwards you say, did I say that correctly? It's like an obsessive compulsive religious thing. So the sin of scrupulosity is missing the point and focusing on perfectionism. So it's really important to remember that the Bodhisattva precepts are enlivening our lives, not deadening our lives. So what we want to do is follow these as guides to our lives. They're descriptions of the mind of awakening, so they inspire us. They're ethical principles. They're inexhaustible objects of study, sources of study. They're koans, which means they challenge us to see things differently. They are ways in which we stay grounded and realize the actual lives of Buddha that we already are. So these are the precepts. The three pure precepts. A bodhisattva vows to avoid all evil. A bodhisattva vows to do all good. A bodhisattva vows to live and be lived for the benefit of all beings. And then the 10 grave precepts. A bodhisattva affirms life and does not kill. A bodhisattva is giving and does not take what is not given. A bodhisattva honors the body, mind, and does not misuse sexuality. A bodhisattva manifests truth and does not lie. A bodhisattva proceeds with a clear mind and does not intoxicate self or others. A bodhisattva sees the good in others and does not slander. A bodhisattva realizes self and other as one, does not praise self at the expense of others. A bodhisattva understanding generosity does not grasp. A bodhisattva actualizes equanimity and does not harbor ill will. A bodhisattva upholds the three treasures, that is Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, community. So those are the Bodhisattva precepts. And the three pure precepts, the first ones, are really central to all the rest. They're impossible and vast. So do no bad. Don't do any bad. Do all good. And live your life for the benefit of others. So they're vast and they require us to do our best moment by moment to develop a kind of humble dignity. Yeah. That we carry into all situations. There's different ways of describing these three pure: avoid evil, do good, actualize good for others, not committing wrong actions, do all good actions, keep the heart pure. In the Dhammapada, it says, do no evil, to cultivate what is wholesome, purify one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So there are some Pali words that are used for this. This is not in the brochure, by the way. But you can ask me about it. Puna. Puna is a word that means uplifting, auspicious, fruitful, creating harmony, generosity, peace. This is known as the unlosable treasure. Puna. Puna. And then the opposite, in Pali they say, is whatever. So apuna means not uplifting, unfruitful, not leading to harmony, not leading to generosity of peace. These are based in the three poisons, greed, hate, and delusion, right? So this is fundamental, fundamental, puna and apuna. Another Pali word that's frequently used to describe actions as kusala. Kusala, the original meaning was intelligent or wise, skillful, uplifting to mental and spiritual states, supportive of a healthy, stable, unencumbered mind and heart. And then akusala is the opposite, unskillful, unencumbered, or encumbered, unwise, not leading to stability, generosity, and peace. So one of the nice things about these words, especially kusala and akusala, is that you can just look at an action. It's kind of neutral. Does this lead to skillfulness? Is it uplifting to the mental and spiritual state? Is it supportive of a healthy, stable, unencumbered mind and heart? Or is it unskillful? Does it lead to an encumbered heart? Does it lead to instability? Does it disrupt generosity and peace? So we can step back and just look at our hearts and minds and thoughts and actions and say, what's our best guess? That's the fundamental stance of the precepts. So purity of heart in this case means intention to live a life aimed at cultivating and expressing puna and kusala. That's what it means. It doesn't mean that you're, you know, somehow endlessly serene and calm and always know exactly what the right thing is to do. It means that you're oriented towards puna, you're oriented toward kusala, you're oriented towards wholesomeness. That's your... In all that you're doing, that's your best guess. So living our lives with this in mind is living our lives with the right spirit. It benefits us and it benefits others. It goes in both directions. This is what we call cultivating a wholesome discipline. So we follow this in our daily lives. If we do, our actions cause less distress, right? Not perfect, but we ratchet down the distress that we're causing to ourselves and others. We hold back biting comments. We cultivate generosity of view. We remember our own limitations. We remember to be thoughtful in our relationships. And when we act this way, we're happier. You know, it seems like saying that hurtful comment will make us happier. But we all know that it won't really, ultimately. That what we're aiming at is far deeper than momentary satisfaction of gotcha. So when we live in relationship, always we're remembering that we're in relationship, whether we like it or not. Always the basis of our lives is relationship. Other people, other beings. So I want to say that another aspect of this is when we give to others, one way of giving to others is allowing them to support us. So it's not, everybody's got their own bent on this. Sometimes accepting support is the deepest challenge. Yeah. So this way of generosity changes us and it changes the world. You bring kindness alive when you practice the precepts in this way. So this is the fundamental orientation of the three pure precepts, and the three pure precepts are fundamental to the life of precept study. This is how we realize the Buddha way. Yeah? This is how we realize awakening. When we do this, another way of describing this is listening deeply. Listening deeply so that we might hear what's at the root of our own being and what's the basis of reality. Suzuki Roshi says, this is in them. He says, we must find what he called our inmost request. He calls this our inmost request. So we listen deeply to what is our inmost request. This is the specific awakening of our altruistic nature. Each of us needs to listen to this because it's particular to you. We must be able to articulate to ourselves how we will manifest our deepest wish for a wholesome life for self and others. So what is the shape of your vow? When we listen to this, we may find that our deepest wish, the wish we want to know ourselves and that we want to be known by others, we may find that the Soto Zen path responds to that inmost request. It fulfills in some way that inmost request. Coming to Ocean Gate, participating in the community, sitting, attending Dharma talks, working together, practice meetings with Shinshu and I, do not require that you take the precepts. I've known many people who will never take the precepts, or at least not that I know of. We had one friend we were at Tassajara with for years, and I think she'd practiced for about 20 years before she took the precepts. So, you know, there's no requirement here. I'm offering this as a way for you to understand what these little bibs are that we wear and understand what's going on. And what an avenue that you might want to take. So, this is the way it works. If you find that your inmost request does involve following these specific precepts, there are steps to go forward. The first step is to establish a relationship with the teacher. So you come and talk to Shinshu and I. It's not required for you to do this, to come here and enjoy our lives together. But you may find that it's helpful to come and talk to us, and you may find that you want to take the precepts, in which case you need to come and talk to one of us. So talk to us about your practice, how you're living out the way, what's going on with you, how do you practice with your ordinary life, tensions at work or losses or struggles or joys, how you understand your evolving life in the way. Then if you want to take the precepts, you ask us. Say, I'd like to do this. We say in here, this is about vow. In a more general way, we make this inmost request public when we participate in the precept ceremony and receive our Dharma name. This ceremony is preceded by precept study and sowing a roksu, which I'll say a bit about more in a minute. Sojin Roshi, Shinshu is my teacher, said the precepts are the lifeblood of the Buddhas. But strictly speaking, there's only one precept. Act as Buddha with compassion and selflessness. When we sow a roksu and publicly vow to engage the precepts koan, we encourage ourselves and others in moral and compassionate conduct. Receiving the precepts, Buddha's lineage papers, Dharma name, and wearing the roksu formally express our wish to benefit all beings through our commitment to Buddha's way. In other words, you say to everyone around you in the community, you say, you can call me out on this. I've made a commitment publicly to be kind, to listen, to be generous, you know, to follow the Buddha way. I want you to know that about me. I want you to know that that's what I'm doing. And I'm going to stumble and fall. I'm not going to do it perfectly, but we're in this together. Yeah. So that's part of what that means. And as a part of that, you sew the roksu. So I brought mine to show you, but other people have one. So this is the roksu, right? It's got a little thing here. And each stitch, each and every stitch is taking refuge. So when you sew the roksu, you work with a teacher. Our sewing teacher here is Sue Walters. And Sandy is also learning that. And the thing is, every roksu is different, and no roksu is perfect. And always you're going to look at it and go, oh, God, those stitches are too big, they're not right, they're not, you know. So you're kind of wearing your mind on your chest when you wear one of these. Everyone can see it, which of course is wonderful because absolutely none of them are perfect. And some are more perfect than others. And then you get a chance to say, oh, well, mine's not as good as theirs, right? And some of us have really lovely little fingers that that work really well. And some of them have what I call Dutch washerwoman hands. And they don't work really well. So you struggle and you stick your finger with the needle and you, you know, it's just, you know, so people can whip one of these things out in an afternoon almost. And others of us take much longer. So this is the front of the roksu. It represents a rice field. It's called a field of blessings or a field of merit. And then the back of the roksu has something written on it. This was when I received Dharma transmission. But the roksu off it will have your name, which I'll talk about in a minute, and the date, and who gave you the precepts. So let me read you what we have written here. This is, by the way, some people say this represents Buddha's robe. This does not represent Buddha's robe. This is Buddha's robe. So there's a way we treat it, there's a way we work with it, there's a way that we regard it, which you will learn if you do this. So let me read what we've got here. Sowing the Rakusu. For hundreds of years, Zen disciples have been sowing the Rakusu. So more than hundreds of years. We continue the tradition by sowing our Rakusus in the style that is called Nyoho-e. Nyoho means life as it is. Ho means Buddha's way. And e means the robe or clothes. So life as it is, Buddha's way clothes. Right? Life as it is. This messy human, even beyond human, interconnected vital life. Sowing the Rakusu is the activity of life itself, the activity of the Dharma fully realized. We wear the Rakusu as our Bodhisattva's vow to benefit all beings. This is Buddha's robe. Sowing the robe is an acknowledgement of the student's relationship to the Bodhisattva vow and the Zen lineage. The student, the practitioner, decides to enter into an exploration of the precepts with a teacher. The teacher decides to enter into an exploration of the precepts with the student. Both wholeheartedly devote themselves to bringing forth the Dharma. So the relationship is two people walking side by side facing the Buddha. Entering this path, sowing the Rakusu, receiving the precepts in a formal ceremony before the community, joining the Buddhist lineage, which means you receive a set of papers that has your name, your teacher's name in it, and your name in it, and you're connected with the bloodline all the way back to Buddha, so the line comes from the Buddha down to you and then back up. So, entering this path, sowing the Rakusu, receiving the precepts, and joining the Buddha's lineage is to enter into an intimate relationship with our deepest vow to enact the Dharma. It is fully immersing oneself in the family of the Buddha. At Ocean Gate Zen Center, taking the precepts is a way that a student can deepen their commitment to practicing the way in their daily life. So, this is, I'll read you a little bit about what we have written here about establishing a student-teacher relationship. Our Zen studies are predicated upon the student-teacher relationship. You have to understand the teacher is our whole life, right? In Zen, we say warm hand to warm hand. This means that the teachings are passed from teacher to student who continue the lineage of understanding. I want you to understand that we say all beings are our teacher, right? Every moment in our life is our teacher. When we enact this interconnecting and interpenetrating reality of our life, our understanding is expressed through our relationships. We do not gain wisdom in isolation. That is why the third treasure, Sangha, our community, is so important. We are Buddhas who follow the way of Buddhas set forth by the historical Buddha Shakyamuni. We continue our practice of the Dharma through our relationships and the Sangha. These are the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Our realization depends upon study, commitment, and enactment of our understanding to fully manifest the richness of this life. In Zen, receiving the precepts is the vow to follow the precepts and join the family of the Soto Zen lineage. This lineage is carried by our teachers and passed to our students warm hand to warm hand. Warm hand to warm hand. Right? So, I want to close here by reading you a couple of quotes that we thought were particularly important. If you try to observe the precepts, this is Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, if you try to observe the precepts, that is not true observation of the precepts. When you observe the precepts without trying to observe the precepts, don't you love it? This is so Zen. That is true observation of the precepts. Our inmost nature can help us. When we understand the precepts as expression of our inmost nature, that is the way as it is. On the other hand, we have the opposite nature, so we want to observe the precepts. We feel the necessity of observing the precepts will help us. And when we understand the precepts in this negative or prohibitory sense, that is also the blossoming of our true nature. So there are these two dimensions to this, right? It's an impossible task, and we devote ourselves to that, and we say, well, we'll never be able to do this. And on the other hand, we say, and yes, I will. Part of the ceremony is when the teacher says, will you undertake this? You don't say, well, I'll think about it, or maybe next week, or I'll try. You say, yes, I will. I will do this. Dogen Zenji says, students of the way, just maintain the Buddha's precepts. Do not forget the swiftness of impermanence. As long as your do-like human life lasts, follow the Buddha's way. So this is the precepts are the mind and heart of the Bodhisattva path. And we commit to them in a good-hearted and intelligent way. This is the basis of compassion for ourselves and others, and a grounded relationship with life as it is. So when we undertake these, we study them, we reflect on them. If you decide to do a formal commitment to them, that's a part of it too. You don't need to do that in order to study the precepts. We should be studying what's wholesome, kusala and akusala, in our lives in whatever way we live. This is one way to express kindness to ourselves and to all beings, to be considerate, to commit ourselves to a wholesome human life.